Hey there, it's Ryan with Season 2 of 50 States of Mind. Before the episode starts, if you can take just a second and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts with something you learned from one of our episodes, it will help us continue with our mission of helping people start a dialogue here in America and overcome our preconceived notions about different parts of the country. Because we all know that one of the keys to bringing us all together is to talk a little less and listen a little more. Are you ready? Let's go. Okay, this is 50 States of Mind. We are continuing with our call-in series, and we have a really, really special guest with us today. What's your name, and where are you calling in from?
I'm Samantha Allen, and I'm calling in from Seattle, Washington.
Ooh, how are things at the former epicenter of COVID?
Terrifying, but growing, I think, less terrifying as time goes on. I think we were actually kind of fortunate in Seattle that we took it seriously really early on because some of those initial deaths in the United States were happening right here. So as soon as that started happening, a lot of employers here sent people home. The governor and the mayor were both fairly quick to act. It took us a while to get to shelter in place, but that's what we're under now. You know, I feel relieved that we're starting to bend the curve a little bit. You know, it's sad how quickly the situation went from friends in New York City being worried about me because I was in Seattle to me just worrying about them and my heart breaking for them because they're in New York right now. But it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel right now.
Yeah, especially when we're all cooped up. You and I think, are kindred spirits in the fact that we like to be on the road. We like to be out meeting people. And you're actually one of the only people I've really talked to, I think, that understands that sort of feeling you get from going and exploring different communities around the country and overcoming your preconceived notions. So I'm really excited to talk to you about a road trip you also took that you chronicled in your book, Real Queer America. Can you tell me a little bit about where the idea came from and what that journey led to?
Gosh, it's weird to think about doing a road trip book today, huh? Real Queer America is a travel memoir that documents a road trip my friend and I took in the summer of 2017 through LGBTQ communities in conservative parts of the country. We started in Provo, Utah, then we went down to Texas, all around Texas, drove up through Arkansas to Indiana, then Tennessee, Mississippi, Georgia, and ending in Florida. And I was really kind of showcasing the vibrancy and warmth and resilience of queer communities and in places that people would assume are hostile to LGBTQ folks. And, you know, some folks still assume that LGBTQ people don't even live there. And I kind of don't blame them given the state of media representation around queer life. That kind of gets into the point of where the book came from. And I had long been frustrated with the fact that the media depiction of queer life in this country is overwhelmingly coastal, focused on basically LA and Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And yet we know that half of LGBT people in the United States basically live in more conservative areas. And their experiences, I thought, were not being represented. You know, I myself lived in Georgia and Florida for quite a long period of time. And I felt an overwhelming desire to kind of showcase what I had seen, especially in the wake of the 2016 election, when I was seeing some liberal Democrat friends, make some derogatory comments about places like the American South or the Midwest.
And that's, I think, the real overlap that we felt. It's that there's a lot of great things going on out there and a lot of people that are doing really hard work in their communities where it's not just handed to them, but no one's really talking about it. So can you talk about, in your book, there's sort of two narratives. There's your narrative of growing and realizing and changing both in the past and the present. And then there's this sort of narrative of you developing a, I don't want to say manifesto, but a very strong point of view about the way things should start to trend in this country. Can you talk about the sort of duality of that?
Yeah, I was trying in the book to braid together both my own story of coming out as a transgender woman in Georgia, meeting my wife in Bloomington, Indiana, and ultimately falling in love and building a life together in Florida. I was trying to braid that kind of personal narrative together with the political conviction that I've developed through those experiences, which is that LGBTQ advocacy in the Southeast, in conservative parts of the United States more broadly, is just so vital, important. The kind of work that these people are doing with such limited resources is remarkable, not only stopping waves of anti-LGBT bills from being enacted, but often getting pro-LGBT legislation passed in really challenging terrain. Utah, for example, just banned conversion therapy. Virginia passed LGBT protections recently. I knew from kind of being immersed in these communities how much good work was happening that was kind of barely registering at the national level. And I wanted to kind of gather all that together and present it in one package, which was the book. And, you know, I know often it helps a political message to have that personal angle attached to it. So, you know, I wanted my story to help serve as a vehicle for that message, but also the stories of the dozens of people that I met and interviewed in these places.
Yeah, and we don't have time to obviously talk about all of them, but I need to emphasize that it's worth getting this book via audiobook, which you read yourself.
Yes, I am bringing back memories of a week spent in a closet in someone's home studio, just slowly losing my mind. But I recommend it to anyone out there who needs something to listen to or is going on a drive, but not to anywhere because you should be staying home.
I would recommend people buy the book, but I don't want someone, you know, reading it that someone else reads it. And, you know, I don't want you culpable at all for any passage of the virus. I think that what you're saying really makes a lot of sense. I was just recording an episode about West Virginia. And West Virginia, which everyone thinks, you know, passed LGBT protections in Wheeling. And even me living here in Kansas City, which is still a metro area, they just started the first Stonewall LGBT and Allied Kickball League, which is kind of a big deal for the city. And you see that when you leave big cities like New York, which is where I used to live, that this visibility actually makes a big difference. And I was really moved by a lot of the stories, especially that gay bar in Jackson, Mississippi.
I mean, what I love about the experience of writing the book or the experiences I've had is you see a lot of this kind of big fish, small pond phenomenon, right? Like one gay bar in a place like Jackson, Mississippi makes this world of difference. Or like I was just talking a few months ago with the organizers of Tri Pride, which was the first Pride Festival in Johnson City, Tennessee. And, you know, I was like, how did this happen? Because they had 10,000 people come out to their first Pride in 2017. It's like, how did it happen? And it was essentially just like, oh, some friends and I were sitting around and we were like, wouldn't it be cool if we had a big Pride like Knoxville? And then we just got together and we did it. It's amazing in a lot of these communities what a little bit of will and a lot of hard work can net you. And that's what I've seen over and over again.
So before we go into the state, if there's a person, an LGBT person listening right now, what message do you have for them about, you know, I live in New York, I live in LA, I'm thinking about maybe moving somewhere else and, you know, having free parking every once in a while, but I'm kind of nervous. I'm not sure if I'll fit in, if I'll find like-minded people. What do you say to someone who's on the fence like that?
I would say that some of the most meaningful messages I've received since writing the book were precisely from people who had recently moved from a place like New York or Los Angeles to Missoula, Montana, or to St. Louis. They admitted to me, like, I was nervous about making this move. I thought that I wasn't going to feel welcome as a queer person, or I thought I wasn't going to be able to find spaces for me like the ones I had back home. And yet reading your book calmed me down, and then going to these places firsthand, often within a couple of months, they were like, yeah, there are spaces. There's this bookstore, there's this cafe, or there's this bar, or there's this, you know, book club that I found. The spaces are out there. There's so much beauty in the middle of this country. And as you said, more parking and more affordable rent for sure.
So I know you've waited, you've wondered what state we're going to be talking about today, and it is a state that you visited on the trip, but I'm not sure it was one of the main features. So I was wondering what you can tell me about what you know about the state of Arkansas.
Arkansas is gorgeous, is the first word that comes to mind. So you're right. I just kind of passed through Arkansas. There's one person I interviewed in Arkansas that made it into the final edit of the book. But I think maybe first it's worth talking about my first visit to Arkansas, which was for the book. You know, this was in July of 2017 that I was writing it. I was traveling through Arkansas because I was coming from Texas to Indiana and decided to cut through Northwest Arkansas. And this was kind of a challenging bit of timing because I was in Texas to help protest the bathroom bill that was being considered that summer in a special session. As soon as that whole experience wrapped up, I was literally in the rental car driving from Texas to Arkansas when my phone just started buzzing and buzzing and buzzing. And I was like, what is happening? Has someone died? Like, what is going on? Apparently, that was the day that Donald Trump had rolled out of bed and decided to tweet that he wanted transgender service members out of the military. And gosh, what a gut punch that was, because it was just such flagrant, open discrimination. Subsequent reporting showed that he hadn't really consulted with anyone. Military leaders had been taken unawares by this tweet storm. And, you know, I have never served in the military, but it felt personal for almost every transgender person in this country to have the president of the United States just kind of putting a target on your back, right? And I was actually on my way to interview a transgender service member in Arkansas that very day. I met with her that same night. But I just remember feeling gutted. You know, here I had set out to write this really optimistic book, and I still felt that optimism, but it was kind of a low point of the trip for me in terms of feeling that like buoyancy or vibrancy or will to go on. I felt like, gosh, as much work as we can do at the state level, all it takes is, you know, some jerk with a Twitter account to roll back something that LGBTQ advocates have fought for years and years and years. But, you know, one of the comforts to me in that moment was crossing the border into Arkansas and then suddenly being in the Ozarks and just like being gobsmacked by the beauty of this place. It was a difficult day, but a day full of just like amazing scenery and then ultimately later really comforting conversations with queer people who lived there.
Well, what I'm hearing is you like Arkansas.
I do. Yeah. Okay. So I went to Fayetteville that night. The transgender service member, former transgender service member I mentioned, lived outside Fayetteville. And then the next day I drove out to Eureka Springs and spent a very beautiful day there. It's a very cute little place and very beautifully situated state parks and forests.
Yeah, I unfortunately didn't get so lucky because when I visited Arkansas and went to Hot Springs, the birthplace of Bill Clinton and the place that hosts a lot of beautiful hot springs, state park operated springs, it was during the 2019 government shutdown. So everything was closed when I got there and I couldn't sit in a big bath of steaming springs. But that city is absolutely gorgeous as well. Definitely worth a visit. And they have a few hot springs that like operate in hotels like spas. And we got to weirdly get a tour of that, which is why I don't have as many recordings from this state. I felt kind of weird going around and like holding a tape recorder or taking pictures inside of a spa where people are sitting in literal bathtubs full of hot spring water. I'm glad you feel the same way about Arkansas because it's one of my favorite states I visited. And I think it's super misunderstood and super underrated.
I have always wanted to go to Hot Springs. So I went to Fayetteville and Eureka Springs when I wrote the book. And then on the book tour, I got to go to Little Rock and do a reading in Little Rock. And I've loved Little Rock as well, a city beautifully situated on the Arkansas River, which was unfortunately dealing with a lot of flooding and the economic impact of the flooding at that time, but also just like rich with civil rights history.
Did you visit the high school?
I did. Someone drove me by Central High School, and you know, I had been to some other kind of sites across the South where, you know, desegregation had to be enforced. It's just always impactful to just even stand there for a moment and feel the weight of that history and grapple with that. And I like that it's both, you know, a high school and a national historic site. I like that in places like Little Rock or Atlanta, where I lived for 5 years, it's impossible to forget about civil rights history because it's around you. You know, I think as a white person, like, I'm grateful that I've had the experience of living in a place like Atlanta or falling in love with, you know, cities like Little Rock or places in Alabama or that kind of thing, because you return again and again to that history, how recent it was, how pernicious the hate was that fueled segregation.
In a lot of ways, monuments to the triumphs we've made, also reminders of how far we have to go. Yeah, it's an important place to visit. And I feel like a lot of people can kind of look down their noses at certain states in the South without ever visiting. And if you do, I feel like it would enchant anyone who's listening, including in Hot Springs. There's a microbrewery that makes beer with hot spring water. It was a magical experience all around, and they brew their own root beer with hot spring water too. So if that doesn't sell you to go to Arkansas, I don't know what will, listeners. So we only have one interview for you today. We had a lot of interesting places we went. We went to a town of 600 people called Palestine, Arkansas, where someone had opened up a restaurant off the highway called the Crazy Donkey Cafe, which had brought in a bunch of new tourism right off the highway. It was kind of a local hotspot for builders to go on their lunch. So people really taking big risks. But what I wanted to talk about was a visit to Arkadelphia, which I had some friends there, and I stayed with his parents, who are English professors at Wachita Baptist College. And I got to talk there to the head of the English department. His name is Johnny Wink. He's been teaching there since 1972. And we got to talk a little bit about civil rights history over the course of his tenure at Wachita Baptist College and sort of the pitfalls and the tension in politics at a Baptist school. So we're going to listen in here.
So you take something like, say, alcoholism, and you say, okay, this is something wrong with you, and I would concede that's right, you know. So if you drink too much, you know, and you are an alcoholic, you probably ought to be helped, and you can be helped. But the way this came up was that we were then talking about how people will make the same kind of judgment, and the way Ibrahim and I see it, go horribly wrong. So, okay, you've got alcoholism, we can fix you. You've got homosexuality, we can fix you. And I know this movie, Boy Erased, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm looking forward to, and I'm thinking of all the tragedy, and I've watched this play out, you know, in my time at Washoe. I don't know why it is, but I've had, in the course of the years I've been here, I've had maybe a dozen people over all these years just come to me and say, I don't know if you're the person I ought to be talking to, but I'm going to see if you are, you know, and just sit here behind closed doors and tell me, you know, I'm lesbian or I'm gay, and you got any advice for being gay at Wachita or being lesbian at Wachita? And, you know, I'm thinking, I wish you luck, you know, because this is a difficult place, and I think it's got less difficult. But, I mean, I can remember every once in a while in the bad old days, somebody would write a letter, you know, some student or even a faculty member one time, talking about gay people in just the most god-awful terms, you know? I mean, the kind of thing that if you'd said something like that about, say, the species called woman or the species called a Negro or, the, you know, there'd have been a hue and cry. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, closeted gay people had to just take it. And I used to always write, I was like Pavlov's dog. I mean, somebody'd write a letter like that and bang, I'm coming back with a letter to the editor expressing a very different point of view, you know, about that. I even wrote the administration once and I said, don't you think that we ought to have truth in advertisement here? I mean, don't you think that in our promotional literature, if we're trying to get people here, don't you think that we really ought to have some little rider clause saying, by the way, Ouachita is not a gay-friendly place. Take as an example this letter, which appeared, you know, with no apologies from anyone, you know. And some people would have written a letter, and we'd have had somebody jump in and say, these views do not necessarily represent the views of Ouachita Baptist University or the school newspaper. But those vile letters that I saw back in the bad old days, you know, they were just printed, and you could do what you want. You could have some goofy old English teacher, you know, who doesn't have any power anyway, writing a letter of rejoinder, but big deal, you know. And I never got any response from the administration. How could they respond? They're in this kind of impossible place. They know that X percentage of people in the world are gay. You don't know, they know there's a gay populace at Ouachita. But on the other hand, they can't come out and say anything. You know, they don't want to run people off by saying we're not a gay-friendly place, you know. We're.
Did that spark any thoughts in you, any epiphanies?
You know, some of what it brings up is having lived in Atlanta and being in Florida at the time of the 2016 election, knowing a lot of LGBTQ advocates across conservative parts of the United States, I think the election of Donald Trump felt less cataclysmic to these folks than to people who've been living on the coasts for a long time. I think a lot of people living in kind of big blue coastal metropolises were taken off guard. They didn't know how this could have happened. It felt like a world-ending event. And it's not to downplay, you know, any, and there is a lot of damage you can point to that the Trump administration has done. But the attitude that I encountered over and over again from these LGBTQ advocates I met and wrote about in the book was like, yes, this happened, but also we're going to continue doing the local, state-level, community-based work we've been doing. We're going to keep building on our gains. They didn't experience it as like this, you know, enormous setback to what they'd already envisioned their next 5 years to look like. I find that attitude really admirable because it's about kind of focusing on what you can change, what you can control, the influence you can have in your community, rather than, you know, watching cable news and just feeling sullen, right?
Yeah, all this kind of boils down to a few main principles, and you've really touched on it. There are huge issues in this country, and you can't fix the giant issue right away, but we have so much power in our communities, in our schools, in our place of work to change the culture. And someone like Johnny is the person that's penning the opposition op-ed saying, you know, it's not wrong to be gay. You know, I grew up in a Christian household and went to Bible camp like every family from the Midwest. And you have to put up with that stuff and you kind of brush it off. But I couldn't imagine being in a place, because I went to a very liberal college, I couldn't imagine being in a place like that where you have to hide because of the religious nature of the school. And I mean, thank God for someone like Johnny, who is showing that he's an ally publicly. And I'm sure he's had a lot of those conversations where kids come in and say, like you said, I'm not sure if you're the one to talk to about this, but I think you might be. That makes a huge impact.
Yeah, I have personal experience at a church-owned school, kind of a different flavor than, you know, a Bible college in the Southeast. But I went to Brigham Young University in 2005 when I was still, you know, in the closet, you know, presenting male, pre-transition. And that was, gosh, I remember how isolating it felt. I was convinced I was, you know, not just the only one on campus, but the only one in Provo, Utah, right? And of course, going back to Provo now, I know that's not true. And yet when you're in that intense, hyper-religious environment, and, you know, not all religions disapprove of LGBT people, but at least at the time, it felt like such a hostile and terrifying place for me to be. And so, yeah, I can imagine like the impact of being able to have that professor you can confide in or someone you can go talk to, because I didn't get that until I left BYU.
Did leaving BYU correspond with leaving the Mormon Church timeline-wise?
Yeah. So I went to BYU in 2005. I actually served 6 months of a Mormon mission before that ended for health reasons. I needed open heart surgery. I'm the only person who's ever been happy to hear that they need open heart surgery. I'm convinced in the history of the procedure, because I was like, I don't want to be a missionary anymore. I am here in San Diego trying to convince perfectly happy with their beliefs Chinese immigrants to come join my weird American, like, you know, sect of Christianity. Like, this is not going to work. It was also just, you know, personally grueling because I was dealing with trying to suppress the kind of budding awareness that I was transgender at the time. But I went back to BYU kind of pre-heart surgery because there was a lag time between when I found out I knew I would need it eventually and when it actually had to happen. And it was during that kind of weird, uncertain period. I was back from my mission, back at BYU. I knew I needed open heart surgery, but it wasn't happening yet, that I had, you know, it all just kind of came to a boil. I didn't feel like I could keep a lid on some of my gender feelings, and I didn't feel like I could intellectually make sense of Mormonism anymore. I didn't feel like I could apologize for my doubts or hide my doubts in, you know, what is a very categorical belief system any longer. And I left BYU in 2007 and formally left the Mormon Church in 2008.
And do you still have friends in the LGBTQ community who remain in the Mormon Church?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, my parents are still members and I have a very close relationship with them. One of the most challenging parts of the pandemic is I'm not sure when I get to be with them in person again. But also when I went back to Provo to write the first chapter of Real Queer America, I made and met so many LGBTQ and allied friends who are still members of the church. And it's an eye-opening experience for me because, of course, I'm sure we'd have a lot to disagree about when it came to Mormonism. And yet when it comes to accepting queer folks as fully human and fully worthy of love and of God's love, like, we see eye to eye. It's the sort of thing where I could waste time with some of these friends, haranguing them, being like, how can you still be in the church? Why are you still in the church? Can't you see this doesn't make sense to still be in the church? Or I could just say, look, it's none of my business what their relationship to the church is. I should just, like, love and meet them where they are. And that was kind of the lesson that I took from going back to Provo and meeting so many of these LGBTQ Mormon and allied families. It's always a tension between folks who say it's better to work outside of the system and then folks who say, well, the system has a big impact, so we should work to change things inside the system. And when it comes to Mormonism specifically, I've made my choice, but I think I've learned to kind of cool it a little bit about people who have made the other choice, right? I feel like when I first left the Mormon Church, burning hot with that, you know, initial apostate kind of anger, right? I was mad at anyone who could stay in it, especially after something like Proposition 8 in California. The more time has gone on, though, and the more people I meet, the more I see them make inroads within Mormonism, that has a tremendous impact. You know, there's still so many youth in Mormon families in Utah who now have something like the Love Loud Festival that they can go to, or a youth center like Encircle where they can spend time. We need both of those approaches because you need to be able to reach people who are still in religions and faith communities. The answer for everyone can't just be, oh, leave. If you're 15 years old and living under your devout Mormon parents' roof, like, leave is not a good answer. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we see this kind of explosion of LGBT youth homelessness in Utah.
The way we talk about it is so lucid. And I feel like in today's society, there's a lot of, if you do this, you're wrong. If you do this, you're wrong. You can't associate with that system. And it's not always as easy as that. And that's one thing I love so much about your book, because it's not just one type of person. It really is the, pardon the term, like, rainbow of the LGBTQ community. It's so many different types of people from so many different walks of life. And it left a big impact on me, and I'm sure it'll leave a big impact on people when they either read the book or listen to the audiobook. In a total shift of gears, I wanted to ask you about your podcast. I have a lot of free time right now, clearly, as we all do, and I think it's about time to turn on a new podcast. It sounds like yours is a great candidate. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. So, you know, like many people, I'm looking for ways to fill the time or have something to chip away at while I'm stuck in self-isolation. So my friends and I, Jen and Sadie, got together and decided that we wanted to rewatch romantic comedies and then record us making an argument for the guy often that the protagonist doesn't end up choosing. You know, so the classic example would be like in Pretty in Pink, Molly Ringwald famously goes with Blaine at the end instead of the hilarious and stylish Ducky. And so our episode will be making the case for Ducky and often in the process kind of bashing and criticizing the guy that the protagonist ends up choosing. It's a lot of fun to kind of deconstruct the rom-com genre, but also to have a mission, which is basically to do apologetics for you know, a spurned and rejected character. So far we've done Sweet Home Alabama, Kate and Leopold, Pretty in Pink, and Leap Year. And we kind of follow the same format every time, but because we're all trapped inside and growing increasingly loopy, we often wander off into weird existentialist asides about, you know, octopus consciousness. Oh, and the title is You Should See the Other Guy, which I was very proud of to find an idiom that perfectly captured the mission of our podcast, which was to tell rom-com protagonists that they should indeed see the other guy.
Are you taking requests as far as films go?
Well, yeah. Do you have a favorite rom-com or do you have a favorite other guy who gets, you know, left or rejected or dumped?
Is it implied in the live action version of The Grinch that Martha Mayhew ends up with The Grinch?
Oh my gosh. I have never seen the live action version of The Grinch, but if there's another guy in it, then that definitely needs to end up on the podcast.
Yeah, there's a mayor character that it's a fierce competition, but it's also a kid's movie. And I think that's a major subplot, like majorly a subplot, like not a major subplot. It's like very, very sub in the plot. Something's got to give.
Oh, that's been suggested among my co-hosts. That's definitely on the list. So who's, oh wait, am I thinking of the right one? Is Keanu Reeves the
yes.
other guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Diane Keaton definitely should have gone with Keanu Reeves over Jack Nicholson.
100%.
Myriad reasons.
You should see the other guy. Send your ears that way. And if you have suggestions, obviously, point out as well. Samantha, this has been such a great conversation, such a good use of our limitless time. Do you have anything else that you want to say about your book or your podcast?
I would just say I've been really grateful these past few days to hear from a few folks who have used their quarantine time to kind of dig into a book that they wanted to get to. And in a small handful of cases, that appears to be Real Queer America. And I've been hearing from folks who've said it's made them feel a little more hopeful or a little more optimistic about things in a time where it can be hard to feel optimism. That's meant a lot to me. And I would just say if you need a little dose of feeling like things are going to get better, I hope that Real Queer America can provide some of that. And otherwise, just want everyone to be safe, stay well, and stay home.
Samantha, thank you so much. This is a great conversation, and keep up your good work and stay safe. Thanks for listening. If you have the time, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to engage with us on social media, we are 50 States of Mind on Facebook and Instagram, and 50 States Pod on Twitter. Special thanks to Bright Moments for the theme music and our entire team for putting in so much hard work. See you next time.